Anna Devontae's time this week in Chicago history. Hi, it's McDome history for starters, isn't it?
this is so interesting because, Bob, this is the stadium that was proposed for the Bears in 1991, like three or four stadium proposals ago. Mayor Daley, January 18th, 1991, told Chicago he had this perfect solution for the Bears and the city. He had teamed up with Governor Thompson to announce they had figured out this plan to get the Bears the world-class modern stadium that they wanted and had been asking for years. So you're right, the solution was McDome, not named for McDonald's. It was a reference to McCormick Place and an expanded McCormick Place because it was such a huge economic and tourism engine for the city. So the plan to modernize it and pour money into it had widespread support. Daley thought, well, let's do McDome right next door, and there'll be even more support for the stadium because we'll kind of roll the public financing in together. So it seemed like this win-win at the time. The Bears desperately wanted the modern stadium. The city desperately wanted to keep the Bears and keep them downtown. And don't forget, the Bears had occupied Soldier Field since 1971, a stadium that wasn't built for them. It was built in 1924, right? So it was a municipal event space. It wasn't a modern sports facility by any stretch of the imagination. So there, all the things they wanted, the revenue generating luxury suites, and they wanted this retractable roof. They had a low capacity stadium. They wanted to improve all these things. So Governor Thompson and Mayor Daley said, McDome will do it. It'll cost projected $300 million, a chunk of that coming from public funds. And that's kind of where things got held up because it didn't get the support. 10 years later, they put about that much, as you know, Bob, into renovating Soldier Field, kind of creating the modern amenities and smushing them into the historic structure, which is kind of the hodgepodge, you know, solution. Bears still looking for a new stadium, as we know, and the McDome idea faded into the dust, and here we are again, all over again.
and back in 1991, they were talking about Northwest Indiana back then, weren't they?
Yeah, Aurora, Hoffman Estates was in play. Northwest Indiana had a proposal. It's kind of the same old, over and over again. You really see history repeating itself when you look back at Bears stadium deals that never got done.
We made history around here this week in 1974 because Illinois was the first state to recognize Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday as a holiday.
You know, that's right. We just marked Dr. Martin Luther King Day Monday, and it's important to note that Illinois was the first state to recognize Martin Luther King's birthday as a holiday and played a pivotal role, really, in establishing the national holiday recognition. This week, 1974, marked the first time any state in the U.S. had recognized the day as a holiday. While members of Congress have been pushing for it since Dr. King's assassination, it didn't have the support it needed. So enter Illinois, then state rep Harold Washington, later Chicago's first black mayor. He introduced the first bill. He stayed on it. He built consensus around it, and eventually the state lawmakers signed it into law. The state of Illinois recognized it for the first time in 1974. And here are a few clips from Harold Washington himself, you know, his own life experience growing up in Chicago that led to this focus on racial unity in the city and the context that drove him to press for recognition for Dr. King.
He's the one who wanted it to be a national day of service, right?
Yeah, you know, he actually was almost disappointed later on when it became just this holiday because he remarked to, and it was on in his autobiography about how, you know, he really wanted this to be a day of reflection of the man's work and a day of service. So he wanted students to study him and the community to volunteer. Today, Bob, it is the only federal holiday designated as a national day of service. So I'm not sure it always happens that way. That's the meaning and intention. It took nearly a decade, by the way, for the U.S. government to approve it, 1983.
And now we remember Betty White, who was born out in Oak Park.
Yeah, 1922, to her Chicago parents, a homemaker mom and a lighting executive dad. While the family relocated to Los Angeles, as we know, Bob, when she was very young, Betty White always cited her Midwestern background as critical to shaping who she was, and it was a big part of her success. Her parents grew up in Chicago's blue-collar neighborhoods. She often talked about their work ethic, their sense of humor, the way they always used laughter to get them through the tough moments in life, and the grounded values she got from her mom in particular, who she said was her best friend. She said it served her so well as a radio performer, a young rising star in the early days of TV, and then in Hollywood and beyond. And who can argue with Betty White? We love her, Bob, but this is the part I think you're going to love the most. We know that she lived to just shy of her 100th birthday, died in 2022, and what she said when she was asked about her longevity, how she made it to be so fit, so sharp, and young into her 80s and 90s, she said the secret, one of the secrets to her long life was diet, and not just any diet, one specific Chicago area delicacy you'll appreciate that shows her Midwestern roots.
I hope Marianne hears that.
Yeah, let Marianne know. The secret to longevity, contrary to what she might think.
I want to use that. Happy birthday, Betty White, born January 17th, 1922. Hill Street Blues. Lots of Chicago references in that program. Anna?
Listeners who are fans of, or fans of Hill Street Blues, back in the day, it was considered the original gritty cop drama before all the TV shows devoted to first responders, before ER, Chicago Fire, Chicago Med, Chicago PD, Law and Order, and NYPD Blue. There was Hill Street Blues, officially set in a fictional town, but the Chicago references and the Chicago inspiration were really clear. The police station where they worked out of, the exteriors was the old Maxwell Police Station on South Morgan Street. There were L train shots, Chicago neighborhood shots, Chicago flags featured. Mercy Hospital was featured in many, many storylines, and city landmarks, too. So Chicagoan Dennis Franz also played a big role in the series. He had that thick mustache that matched his equally thick Chicago accent. And it was one of those TV shows that broke a lot of new ground in television, because it was this ensemble cast with overlapping stories that are pretty common today. That handheld camera work that kind of gives you that documentary style feel, that you're going along with the cops on their journey of wherever they're showing up that day. You had these flawed characters and tough choices, and kind of projecting the realness of inner city police life. Dennis Franz, by the way, went on to star and made a bigger name for himself in NYPD Blue. So he became a New York cop, but I still think he had that Chicago accent going pretty strong, even though he did that. But a really cool show, Hill Street Blues, that I know a lot of people in Chicago followed.
Man, it was a great show. And, you know, Dennis Franz, great guy. Dennis Farina also right out of that.
Yeah,
mold.
He was in it, too. Mm-hmm.
This week in Chicago history, the Cubs were sold. Tell us about this.
This is a fun one, Bob. Flashback to the front page of the Chicago Tribune 110 years ago, January 16th, 1916. The big news in town was that a group of local business titans had purchased the Chicago Cubs baseball team. It was a group led by restaurant chain owner Charles Wiegman, who joined with Julius Rosenwald of Sears Roebuck and Company, Ogden Armour of the meatpacking fame, and William Wrigley Jr., who was the chewing gum magnate at that time, only really known for that. They bought it from the brother of a former U.S. president, Charles Taft, half-brother of William Taft. Fun fact, Wiegman owned another team and that league had folded. So he had a field already, Wiegman Field, later Wrigley Field. Over the years, Wiegman's restaurant business sort of struggled, and so he sold his shares and a majority stake went to Wrigley and the rest. As they say, it's history, but it's
1916,
pretty cool to think about.
Yeah. And this was the week in 1991 that we first saw the super fans, the Bears.
Yeah, the Bears. We loved them from the beginning, Bob. The Bears super fans debuted on SNL right before their playoff game against the Giants January 12th, 1991, letting the world get a glimpse of Bears fans' blind loyalty to the team and equally blind love for Coach Ditka while they chowed down on their brats and beers and discussed the important things about the Bears and sports. It was officially known as Bill Swirsky Superfans and hosted by Joe Mantegna for that first episode alongside Todd, Chris Farley, Pat, Mike Myers, and Carl, Bob Smigel. We pulled a clip from the Superfans who had the honor of appearing on the 100th anniversary of the NFL special. The Superfans set up their card table outside Soldier Field and decided to school none other than Brett Favre on why the Bears were superior to the Packers, and they even developed their own version of Siri to fact-check Brett Favre on the Packers' success.
The debut of the Superfans this week in 1991. Well, they were ahead of their time. That was way before Alexa, wasn't it?
Yeah. Siri. So let's hope there's reason to bring them back next season, Bob. Let's hope so.
More This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis again next Wednesday. Thank you, Anna. Have a good one.
Sure, Bob.